This episode is made possible by you. HRN is a member-supported nonprofit, and our coverage is only possible thanks to your generous support. Learn more later in the show, or just go straight ahead to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This is Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for 10 years. After all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices of our network. Each week, I record my show in the HRN studio because I'm excited to bring you, our listeners, the most important stories from the world of beer, food, cider, and more. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. You can even show some love for my show by selecting Beer Sessions in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, I'm Jimmy Carboni, and today is Tuesday, July 16th, 2019. We've got some great guests on the show. We've been talking about local malt, slow grains all week. Tomorrow is our New York City Brewer's Choice 9th annual event in Williamsburg. You can check it out at nycbrewerschoice.com if you're listening live. But the reason that it's an important event is that it's evolved. You know, 10 years ago, it was like people were just opening craft breweries, and people were just opening craft beer bars, good beer sealed bars. And now things have come a long way. And back in 2014, when we did the New York City Brewer's Choice, it was the first time we worked with Grow NYC Regional Grains and Valley Malt out of Massachusetts, which was the only malt facility in the Northeast for like many, many years. And things have come so far, so fast. And our guests today, we're going to talk about that story. Everyone, please introduce yourselves. Start with the guys from Subversive.
Yeah, I'm Max Ocean. I am one of the founders and owners of Subversive Malting and Brewing in the Hudson Valley.
Great.
Zane Coffey, head one of the brewer from Subversive Malting and Brewing, one of the founders.
Great.
Hey, I'm Jeff Lyons from Keg and Lantern.
So, Jeff, you've been around with us for a while. I mean, part of the story of local malt and the changing craft beer scene in New York City was definitely the influence of all the homebrew clubs and BGCP classes and homebrew events. When did you first start seeing people work with local malts as a home brewer and then as a pro brewer?
So I feel like I was pretty early on just because I was sort of in the presence of Chris Prout. He was one of the founders of the Brooklyn Bruisers Homebrew Club up in Greenpoint. And, you know, I remember him loading up, driving his pickup truck to Andrea at Valley Malt and loading the back of it up, bringing it all back, and then brewing with it for months himself and trying to get the bruisers to brew with it at home. And then once he transitioned into opening up Greenpoint Beer and Ale as the head brewer there, we just had a standing order. So anytime Andrea had a pallet worth of malt, she'd ship it out to us. So I feel like he was really pushing really early on and really supportive of the whole concept. So I feel pretty lucky to have been around, tasted a bunch of the beers really early on and sort of watched the evolution from that into sort of being a little bit blessed about the number of people that we're able to work with now.
Yeah, and I remember that in 2014, it was an amazing thing that really established great brewers like Jeff O'Neill, who then was at Peekskill, and Phil Leinhardt, who was at Omegang. For this event we did in 2014, they were taking the chance and working with the local malts, which a lot of them hadn't worked with on a larger scale. And they had complaints about it. You know, it didn't quite always work with the machinery, or there were a lot of issues that came up. But I thought then, and I still do, that whenever brewers work with local malts, that their beers are better than the, than otherwise. So you guys, Subversive, you have a great story. So you're like this new generation where you started. Tell us how you guys got started. I want to hear the story. You won a competition to fund your business.
Yeah, we won $25,000 our senior year of college. But I mean, our idea we wouldn't have even come up with.
So you did. Like. You won this prize. I'm gonna cut. You know, you didn't decide to make cookies or some other vegan coconut snack like. Some people have really stupid business models that win these competitions, but you guys actually did something real.
Yeah. A lot of it was, we were both very interested in beer, in brewing. We both started homebrewing in college. I moved out to Oregon. I took a year off and really steeped myself in the craft beer scene there and got very, very excited about beer and about flavor and about sort of the whole scene. And then coming back to college, we really doubled down on home brewing and getting really interested in beer, and then also the intersection with local agriculture.
And we just, yeah, we realized that where the industry was at that point was, it was still in this period where it was really very fledgling. I mean, I think there were 3 malt houses in New York at that point. Plus Valley was malting New York grain for New York brewers.
We're really the pioneers of the East Coast craft malting.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Valley Malt and Farmhouse Malt and Farmhouse Brewery, Marty Matrazzo and Owego, New York, were kind of our 2 early inspirational models, along with Evan Watson at Plan B a little bit, because they had kind of paved the way and showed that this path would be possible for us. And also Valley Malt, I mean, what they push with experimental malts was hugely inspirational to us, because we didn't want to get into this and just make base malts. We wanted to kind of use that, the malt house, as a creative outlet to, you know, work with heritage grains and interesting varietals and processes as well.
So what was your business pitch that you won the competition for? You're called Subversive Malting and Brewing. So how did you tie in the malting?
It was a combination malt house brewery that we'd pitched. And the idea was to wholesale malt for other brewers and then to produce enough malt for ourselves to run a small brewery, and really focus on malt as an extra sort of process step in the brewery to really explore flavor and dive a little bit deeper into the brewing experience.
Yeah, I mean, we have this little pub right in Catskill, New York now that we opened about 6 months ago, and it's a wonderful opportunity as maltsters to be able to serve that glass of beer directly to the drinker and start that conversation. Everybody likes beer, right? But most beer drinkers don't really know what malt is. So by having that kind of sexy end product, so to speak, we're able to start that conversation about the supply chain with our customers and hopefully, you know, add a little bit of value to what people like Jeff do, what people like Jason at Strong Rope do, right, who maybe aren't maltsters themselves.
Jeff, I'm impressed with these guys, because what's different, in 2014, we literally had to corral groups like Grow NYC Green Markets and you know, the Brewers Guild and New York City Beer Week, and try to get everybody on board. Hey, let's try to get 20 brewers to make a batch of beer with local malt. And this year we put out the word, and guys like Evan Watson at Plan B says, Jimmy, I've only been using local malt, and 6 years ago I would drive 6 hours to get to Marty Matrazzo's to get the malt. And now you guys, out of the blue, Subversive, I'd seen you on some social media. I know that you guys supported Common Roots Brewing after they had their fire. But you guys were like, no, man, this is what we do. So, I mean, just in 5 years, it's come so far, Jeff. I don't know what your take on it is, because I think this is cool. I mean, it's like, we're talking about local ingredients in beer. I mean, what's more important than malt?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the soul of beer, right? 100%. No, it's fantastic. We traditionally have used so many ingredients that come from overseas and from so far away, it becomes sort of intangible and just so far removed, and you're just taking this product and you lose touch with the whole supply chain. And you know, not only are these great guys who are incredibly fun to have some beers with and let loose, but like to be able to do that with somebody that, you know, is potentially supplying you with an ingredient that you're then honing your craft and making the thing that you love to make with something that they love to make. It's really nice to have that direct relationship and that direct line of communication, which I think is, a huge part of what makes community, which is a huge part of what makes craft beer to me.
But Max and Zane, so you guys, you're malting, but you're really just malting just enough so that you can brew.
Yeah. I mean, there was about 10 months we were selling malts. You know, we're the smallest malt house out of, I think there's 12 or 13 of us in the state now. We're the smallest currently in New York, though we're making some steps to scale up in the next few months. So the plan was always to primarily focus on supplying ourselves. We thought we'd be able to supply a few accounts in the meantime, but pretty quickly when we opened the brewery, which is just 7 months ago now, we realized that it made a lot more sense to focus on supplying ourselves. And the thing that we're really trying to do that's different is we're not just trying to do our own base malts, we're trying to do every step of processing in-house, whether it's, you know, kilning to a slightly higher kiln malt, or whether it's roasting grain and malt to make a dark beer.
I know that like Hudson Valley Malts in Germantown, I've been there to Dennis Nezel, and I even know for distillers like Copper Sea and their New Paltz, they're using these like traditional kind of floor kilning setups. But you're not doing that. Tell us what you did and why you decided to malt the way you do, how you're malting. Give us that story, because that's very interesting.
So we, in planning the whole business, we had originally looked at floor malting partially because of how sexy it was and how gorgeous it looks to have a big piece of malt on the floor and to turn it and all those things.
And it's kind of the traditional method, right?
And it's the traditional method.
So it's like you're raking it and shoveling it.
Exactly. But as we...
And there's heat underneath, right? Is that the... How does it work?
No,
it's a floor, and how does it get heated?
So when it's on the floor, it actually doesn't really get heated. It generally, that's just when it's germinating. So you let the grain germinate for a couple of days after you steep it.
Yeah, you actually want that floor to be a cold thermal mass to make the grain not get too hot, right?
Yeah, so it needs to start growing really, really slowly. So you can control basically how much they modify in relationship to each other, so it doesn't get out of whack. But it takes a lot of floor space to do floor malting, obviously. So in our business plan, because of our space requirements, we decided to go towards a pneumatic system. So it's a big stainless steel vessel that has a false bottom, sort of looks like a mash tun, actually. It's really big.
So we installed the false, it was a used soda syrup tank we bought off eBay for like $400. Got a friend to weld a floor in it, and it's basically perforated stainless sheets that we, you know, screw onto the, you know, frame, and that allows us to push air underneath that grain bed, basically. So we can have a grain bed that's like three or four times as thick as Dennis at Hudson Valley would be able to have floor malting.
So it's a much smaller space requirement. And we have, you know, we have temp probes that control all the air flows and how humid it gets. So we can dial in very exactly what kind of malt that we want. And then in that vessel, we hop in and we turn it. So it doesn't quite look like traditional floor malt rakes. You know, we hop in with a shovel and turn it and give it a really good mix. And then once it's done germinating, basically once the acrospire has reached the point where all the starch has really been unlocked, we just kiln it in that same vessel. And it's about baking temperatures generally. So, and it's really analogous to baking. So you can bake it, kiln it in the malt at low temperatures, and that's where you get a Pilsner malt. And then you can step it up, you know, 20.
What are the temperatures that you try to hit?
So, you know, for a Pils malt, you're going, you know, somewhere around 150 to 180. And that's sort of how you dial in your, the, you know, the SRM that you brew with. And then pale malts, 20, 30 degrees above that. And then we have the capacity to go up to about like a Vienna. And that's, you know, we hit that 250, 270.
And you get some really awesome, you know, color and flavor development once you get up to those temperatures. It's same base grain, creates a completely different product.
This is cool, Jeff, isn't it? Have you ever malted grain before?
I haven't.
Yeah, I want to come up and do it.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, so you brought one of the beers that you're going to be serving at New York City Brewer's Choice tomorrow.
Indeed.
Just tell us about this, what the beer is, but in particularly the malt that's in it and how you made that malt. So, if you made it.
This is called Drinking Beer. We make 100% of the malts in all our beers. So Drinking Beer, DRINKENBIER, right? It's a little bit of a fun name. I mean, a lot of people get confused when they come in if they haven't been in before and their friend has been in and they order drinking beer.
Drunk in German, right?
Yeah. But yeah, kind of just out of the gate was our, we didn't have any dialed in recipes when we opened because we hadn't worked with our own malts a whole lot before. And we had just kind of gotten the new heater that allowed us to push our kiln temperatures up to those Vienna temperatures like a month before we started brewing commercially, right? So we had this new product that brought a lot more flavor to our beers that we hadn't worked with before. And we put some of it in a lager, just a little bit, and it, you know, gave some more malt depth to the beer. And out of the gate, it was just a hit, and it's been about a quarter of the volume we've sold out of our tap room since we opened.
Yeah, so it's a Keller lager that has a lot of pils, a little bit of pale malt, and a touch of Vienna, just to give it some of that nice dark, you know, some of those nice tasty crackery, you know, bready things happening.
Yeah, a little more malt sweetness than like a pils would have, mm-hmm. or anything like that. But.
Yeah, Jeff?
I just have to call you out that it's awfully brilliant for a Keller beer.
In
a good way. In a very, very, very
I like
good way.
Like malt forward beers. It's not like, and you guys know what I mean. But when I say malt forward or malt friendly, what's a good way to describe this flavor profile, Jeff? Because it's not like American beers. It's not a hop forward beer.
No, I think you're on the right track. I think if you're talking about a lager, I think this is very much falls into a malt forward. You know, beer for a lager. I think those Vienna notes sort of.
Yeah, I mean, do you say Vienna lager? I know I would expect this, but do you feel like you have to explain the flavor profile to anyone, or how would you explain the flavor profile other than just saying it's a Vienna lager?
I mean, it's a tough thing. Yeah, we don't want to box ourselves in and call anything a Vienna lager necessarily, right? Because we're working with New York ingredients. We're not working with something from Vienna. I mean, aside from some yeasts. So I mean, I guess we're not really, you know, when Zane writes recipes, but we both kind of work on where we want a beer to go together, and we never are driven by a style definition. We're always driven just by trying to make good beer, and then we kind of, after we have a product, try to define it in a way that our customers are going to be able to understand, right? Because our customers do tend to think of beers within style categories to some extent.
For us coming up with the beers, we usually start off with a style as an idea, and then take the ingredients that we have and sort of build around that concept. Because I mean, our ingredients are our ingredients.
Ingredient driven beer.
Very much.
Our goal was to make a tasty lager. It wasn't to make a Vienna lager whatsoever, right? But it might be somewhat representative of one.
I think that's one of the most exciting parts about dealing with New York ingredients is that you're not just trying to mimic something. You're not able to make the same IPA that everybody else is making or you know, whatever the example is. But it's, to me, the excitement is that you get uniqueness out of all these ingredients, and almost the smaller that you are, you know, like these guys, like you're creating something that no other maltster in the state, even if they were taking the same grain in, is going to make, just because their system's different. In the same way that different breweries can use the same ingredients and create different beers, you know, these ingredients are different. It creates and pushes you into different areas. And I really think that we're, if we are even to the point of scratching the surface, we are so at the beginning of this, and I find it really exciting to find out where we might be in 2 or 5 or 10 years time, as far as utilizing these ingredients and letting them take us where they take us and kind of creating our own unique styles just because the ingredients take us there.
Yeah, 100%.
It's like you got a laboratory there. It's like I got a smoker that I smoke meat in. I want to get one of these. Tell us again the name of this malt machine.
It's a pneumatic system. Actually, for a little historical context, I think, is it called a Galland box, technically? Or I forget. It was some French guy. I forget his name. I'd have to look that up. But the Saladin box was what came after. Yeah. And basically, this was like the way we malt was like the first advent away from floor malting, right? And it was attempt in industrial areas to use square footage as, you know, it got more and more expensive to use it more efficiently. And so this guy figured out this way, but he kind of gave it up after a few years because it was so much work to turn the malt physically once that grain bed gets, you know, 30 inches thick or whatever compared to the, you know, six, eight inches on the floor it might be.
And it soaks up a ton of water, so it gets even heavier. So if you put in, you know, 1,000 pounds, it'll be almost 2,000 pounds of stuff that you have to turn once it soaks the water up.
So he gave it up after a couple of years, but his pupil, Saladin, thought, I could mechanize this, and he put mechanical screws that went back and forth through the grain bed, and that was probably the biggest industrial achievement we've ever seen in malting. You know, it's still kind of how most industrial malt houses work.
How many years ago was this?
It was late 1800s at some point, yeah.
Yeah. Where did you find your knowledge about malt? I mean, did you read, like, John Mallett, we know, has the malt book.
So there's a great book. It's Dennis E. Briggs, and which is one of the big seminal texts that everyone reads if you're serious about malting. But it's all aimed at very large industrial malt houses. So Christian and Andrea are actually really
from
Valley Malt in helping us create and troubleshoot some of the things. But then Hartwick College put on an advanced craft malting course, technical course. And that was where we actually got a lot of sort of hands-on.
Hartwick's sort of cool. There's guy Aaron. Is he
Aaron
still
McLeod?
There?
Well, he was.
So Aaron worked in Canada and for these big malt.
Yeah, I mean, really,
he was like one of the experts on malt.
100%. I mean,
America,
he worked,
right?
Sending millions and millions of pounds of malt from the Canada over to the Chinese government, and the Chinese government needed like this special like lab procedure done and everything. So it was a real like total change of course for him to start working with guys like Christian and Andrea and eventually us. But we cannot overstate the importance to the industry, not just in New York, but nationwide, that Aaron has played. I mean, his lab is the best and most accessible in the country. He's so accessible via phone. Hands it's like having a $1 million lab that we didn't pay for, basically.
1.5.
And I mean, all 100 craft maltsters pretty much nationwide are using his services in some
way. This is a little college in the New York State.
Yep. Hartwick College in Oneonta.
New York's got some cool stuff. Jeff, let's just go back. So, you know, a few years ago, you were getting some malts through Chris Prout, and you guys were homebrewing with it. But it's come a long way. But still, how are you able to get local malts? Do you get it at Keg and Lantern, or are the homebrewers getting it, or is it still limited supply?
There's more of them, and there's more volume. So I think there's a pretty decent number of breweries in New York State who are using New York malt, at least sometimes, if not predominantly. But I think that it's still very difficult. I think those supply chains are not really set up yet for them to service directly to a homebrew shop, which is how almost all homebrewers have to get their ingredients. So yeah, we had Chris with the Bruisers. Chris has sort of moved on from that. I still go to the Bruisers, so I end up getting a lot of malt from Ted Hawley, who's been on the show, from New York Craft Malt. And So I buy that to use at the brewery, and then I use that at home quite often. And then sometimes we'll put together projects, or if one of the Bruisers wants to use some local malt, they can.
And also, Jason has strong rope. Sometimes homebrewers will get malt from him.
Jason's awesome about that. And even I go and take little bits of specialty malt to sort of diversify what's available to me.
Yeah, Jason was one of our original customers when we were selling malt, and still to this day, every once in a while, we'll see somebody like tag us on Instagram or something. You know, I haven't sold him malt in like almost a year probably, but he's still doling it out there for homebrewers to.
And let's give a quick shout out. So just in 5-6 years, again, before, not too long ago, it was just Valley Malt in Massachusetts. Who are some of the, you know, the really good maltsters out there in New York State that you guys would recommend? When I'm going to say Hudson Valley Malt.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really cool. We're, you know, 10, 15 minutes from Dennis and, yeah, you know, kind of had both kind of come up with ideas around the same time, I think, but he opened a couple of years before us and just as a malt house, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's been awesome to see him really hit his stride. And I mean, it's like all the great brewers in the Hudson Valley are buying malt from him, and we couldn't be happier about that. You know, Hudson Valley, Industrial
Ted
Arts.
Makes some really nice
malt. New York too. Craft malt.
Yeah, yep. New York craft malt. Yeah.
And what about for you, Jeff?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit limited in the scope, but I mean, Ted's my guy. He's fantastic. I cherish him, you know, as a friendship, but I think he's making really great malt too. So I'm really happy to do that. But I really like Noel. I do think that there's some value to having somebody as big on the block as 1886. And you know, there's a sort of runs the gamut. It's nice to have some diversity and some of size and of flavor going on.
And specifically with Ted, I'm pretty sure he's the only guy wholesaling, at least on any significant volume, a lot of specialty malts to New York brewers, right?
From my perspective, yes. Yeah. I could be wrong and I could be overlooking some, but yes, I feel that way.
Let's talk about the next beer you guys brought from Subversive. What's this beer?
So this is called Body. It's a...
Or Body Double IPA.
Yep. Hazy IPA. A lot of Tahoma.
You guys are a good team. I like
a lot of Michigan Copper.
Max and Zane.
yeah, just a sort of big, going a little thicker, going a little hazy.
So when we talk about making hoppy beers in New York, right, we're pretty limited as far as varieties go, and a lot of those sexy varieties that you probably see on the beer boards and all the cool bars, right? Citra, Simcoe, Mosaic, those are proprietary, and New York growers aren't able to grow them, at least at this point in New York. But we are starting to see, you know, 6-7 years in, people are finding out what works with the terroir in New York State, and Great Lakes Hops, which is a breeder out of Michigan, has developed some proprietary hops that they're licensing pretty inexpensively to New York growers. Michigan Copper, which is one of the hops that's dominant, and the dry hop in this beer being one of those. And I think that's really just the tip of the iceberg of what we'll probably see on the hop cultivation side long term. I think we'll find varieties that are aromatic and grow well in New York as long as people, you know, keep buying and supporting it. That supply chain is going to really figure it out.
Jeff, outside, you guys were talking about a hop you called Mystery Hop.
So you know, our local go-to, if you want to drink beer with local ingredients, or you want to try to learn about local ingredients in a finished form, you know, the sort of local guru is Jason Saylor at Strong Rope. He's been, you know, homebrewing with it before he opened, and then, you know, since Strong Rope opened, he's been pretty much 100% New York ingredients, so... We used to be able to go out there, and he used to put it right on the menu, and you just drink your way through and just try to figure out what's what and what's creating what flavors. And there was a point a couple of years back where, you know, so many of the beers that you were just like, wow, this is sort of knocking my socks off. What's going on with this? And the answer was almost invariably like, oh, that's the mystery hop. And we knew where it came from, but the person who grew it, it's Whipple Brothers. They kind of lost track a little bit. Maybe their paperwork wasn't so tidy, and they couldn't remember what they put in that row or in that field. So they knew they had something really good, but they didn't know exactly what it was. And then, so that's sort of the origin of that.
You still
story.
Call it Mystery Hop?
Well, yeah, I think he came to realize that he was pretty certain it was Columbus. So he puts it out now as CTZ. So yeah. A little bit later, we can crack a beer. I made a Saison that I'll be pouring tomorrow night at your event at the Brewer's Choice that features that hop.
Great. We're going to take a short break. Engineer's going to cut to a little message, and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by you. This is HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, and I want to personally acknowledge you. Our entire 10-year history of groundbreaking food and beverage audio journalism has only been possible because of listeners like you. You usually hear from our incredibly supportive network of business partners during these show breaks, but this week, we're taking a moment to thank the thousands of individual donors who've been part of our family since the very start. You listen to HRN because you care not only about what's on your plate and in your glass, but how it got there and the stories of all of the people, plants, and animals that contribute to the food supply chain. So please, this week, take a moment to show us what independent food radio means to you and become a member of HRN. Help us deliver another 10 years of storytelling that will shape the world during a critical time for politics, innovation, food ethics, and the planet. With your help, we can change the world and our food system one soundbite at a time. There's no food radio without you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate before July 31st to do your part to ensure a bright future for your favorite food podcasts. That's heritageradionetwork.org/donate. From all of us at Heritage Radio Network, we thank you for your vision and generosity from the bottom of our hearts.
Commercial.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Check it out, HeritageRadioNetwork.org. It is the membership drive this summer. Check it out. It's really important. There's over 30 shows. It's a nonprofit. You can become a member and really keep this thing going for another 10 years. We're in our 10th year now. There's the Heritage Radio Network Hall of Fame. A lot of our top guests are on there. Just keep checking it out, heritageradionetwork.org. So, guys, thanks for joining me. We've got Subversive Malting and Brewing and Jeff from
Keg and Lantern.
All right. So we're drinking beer and talking about malts. So, Jeff, what did you bring?
So I brought a couple of things. I think the conversation earlier sort of, I think you were skirting the issue of like talking about New York Hop Guild and Chris Holden and and talking about some of that stuff. So we actually made a beer, I don't know, about a month ago or so, giving up my timeline on my lagers. but we did a collab. So Chris Holden's sort of the front facing, sort of the face and the sales side of the New York Hop Guild. He's been on the show too, right?
Yes.
Really good dude, and so he talks to me a lot about different hops, and we go back and forth, and he was like, hey, I got my hands on this hop called Petit Blanc, and he had enough that we could, you know, rub a little bit of it and smell it and talk about it, and then so he's like, hey, you know, why don't I come down, I'll bring the hop and we can make a beer. And then I think he had the same conversation with Browns in Troy, New York. And then he ended up only with like one bag of the hop being sent from Germany. So he was like, hey, why don't we just all do it together? So the guys, a couple of the guys from Browns came down, made a beer with us. So we made a Bohemian lager with a hop from Germany called Petit Blanc. So that's
very cool. That's right. Let's taste it.
And yeah, just so people understand what Chris is kind of doing, New York Hop Guild, you know, Chris with Crooked Creek, he's been at it for a while. He was definitely one of the early guys on the hop side in New York, but now he's kind of working to be this supply chain solution for people, and he's focusing on, you know, New York hops from multiple other growers other than himself. You know, it's not just him involved with the guild, but he's also focusing on bringing some really interesting varietals. You know, we're not buying any of them because we're 100% New York, but he's bringing some really interesting European varietals stateside and distributing those to New York brewers as well.
Well, this tastes like a Bohemian Pils, Jeff. You always hit it.
I hope so.
You are. I think one thing about the focus on local malts this week is that I'm so interested in lagers and Helles and Keller beers more so than ever. And we've done quite a few shows in the last 6-7 months about it. I love your enthusiasm for it, Jeff.
Absolutely.
So you said it take you made this a month ago. Is time an issue when you make lagers?
For a lot of people, it is.
Yeah, that's super clean.
it's a tasty beer.
I really like, I mean, this is all relative, right? So I'm not talking about like the amount of esters that you might find in a Saison that we might pour here in a minute. But, you know, relative to the style, I like a yeast expression in a lager. I like a little bit of ester, and I like that yeast to be present. And I've sort of come to think about even lagers as sort of a farmhouse style, or, you know, that rustic style, or approaching it in that way. And I think when you do, you can turn things around pretty quickly, and they're still pretty clean. Hopefully no diacetyl, no sulfur, none of these off flavors, no DMS or anything like that. But you just get a freshness that you don't get if you just put it in the cooler and forget about it for 6 or 8 or 12 weeks. Or, you know, we had CBC in Denver and Bierstadt, which is made incredible beers, but I mean, they talk about like 200 and some odd days sometimes for some of those beers, and it's
that's wild.
It just blows your mind how long they're lagering it. But I just, you know, if we can get a beer there in 2 weeks, I'm happy to do it.
Yeah,
Zane, what's your take on time?
Really depends on the beer. I think it's very, very beer dependent, and it goes back to what Jeff was saying. Is like if you want to have a little bit of the vibrancy kind of thing, yeah, a little fresher coming, getting it out of the tank is nice. But some of the beers too, you want to have sit and lager for a long time and just really have everything work through some of those gawky moments that the beer has and that sort of.
But we're pretty new to brewing lagers too. I mean, as homebrewers, we didn't have the infrastructure to do it. So we're really kind of figuring it out right now.
And then, let's go back to malt. So, what grains are being grown in New York, in particular, that seem to be best suited for you guys to malt for making beer? I know that even 5-6 years ago, there was talk about odd grains like emmers and ryes because they were seen to grow better for farmers. But what's becoming the best grain for malts in New York?
Yeah. So barley is the short answer for now.
Barley for beer barley is the best beer. Grain. That's just how it is. It's that simple.
And there's some really, really good barley being grown in New York. And a lot of it has, a lot of it has to do with the farmers taking barley malt and malting like very, very seriously. A lot of it has to do with Aaron McLeod at Hartwick.
One of the big challenges we see, though, is that farmers, for the most part, have to buy this seed from seed companies, right? And seed companies are, for the most part, making varieties available based on, like, recommendations from places like Cornell. So they'll make a recommendation, have a seed available for a couple of years. Farmers will put a lot of resources into learning how to grow that variety, and then sometimes that variety will disappear because, you know, the seed company sells seeds to a variety of industries, and just from, you know, a simple business standpoint, selling that seed varietal wasn't profitable enough for them. So we're kind of getting through those issues, I think. But I think in the first seven years, those have been some pretty big issues for a lot of growers. We're working with a variety right now. I mean, we malted one variety for about 18 months, Newdale. It's a spring two-row variety. We love how it malts, but it's very difficult to grow in New York. I mean, this is what the guys at Maine Malt House grow almost exclusively Newdale, right? They were shipping this barley up to Canada before they started malting it themselves. So it grows great a little north of here. But with the humidity and heat we get in New York, it's a little bit more difficult. But we've malting these test plots that our farmer grew for Cornell Cooperative Extension. And Violetta is really performing great in the malt house. Zane will tell you a little bit more about why. And what's really great about that variety is that our farmer will be able to save seed and not have to worry about going back to that seed company for that variety.
Yeah. Shout out to Rachel from West Wind Ag.
Yeah, Rachel McDermott now. She was in New York City in finance for a while and went back to the family farm, and she's kind of helping shepherd them to the next generation.
So is that also Westwind Orchards too?
No, it's not. Else. That's something else. Yeah. They're in Scaticoke, so a little northwest of Albany. They've grown feed grain for the dairy industry in New York for a long time, but dairy is currently tanking in New York. So
she really was.
So they had been growing grain.
Yeah, they had a lot. Yeah, they had the biggest, grain bins east of Syracuse in New York State, if I'm not mistaken.
So they have experience growing
and
high quality grain
already.
Yeah, which is super important. And one of the things that for smaller farmers is basically impossible to grow high quality malting barley because the infrastructure isn't there.
And even if you can grow it, you can't store it properly, right? One of the big things we've seen in the supply chain for malt is maltsters can't afford large grain bins, and they're trying to basically buy relatively small amounts of grain at a time, right? Add value to that grain and then sell it to a brewer and then use that profit to buy more grain. So the farmer at this point anyway really needs to be able to store that grain under proper conditions. It needs to maintain its germinative ability for 12 to 18 months.
And there, that's a lot of risk that the farmer has to put up with.
about a year ago, there was a Facebook post with a farmer I knew. He said, you know, my friend has a, he had an order of Red Fife, you know, wheat. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was destined for a bakery, but the bakery decided to not take it. And he started asking brewers, you know, if what to do with it. And I contacted Andrew at Valley Malt.
Yeah.
And the first question was, you know, what's the analytics on it? So tell us that process. If someone just grew grain, they grew it for bread, but now they want to sell it for brewers, you know.
That's where Aaron Blout comes in, right? Yeah, I mean, it's why he's so critical. We can't just take it from a farmer just because they say it's a nice product. We need to know it's going to work in the malt house.
And that's that Aaron McLeod is key.
But is that a job for the farmer? Like, should farmers know that there's certain things they should be analyzing for?
Yeah, I mean, a farmer should not try to sell their grain to a maltster without sending it to Aaron or another lab, basically.
And and talk to Aaron before you plant anything to know what your specs are. And, you know, because there's a whole interaction between, like, nitrogen application and protein on and all these things. And if you don't know what spec you're trying to hit, you're just sort of shooting all
over. You could throw a bunch of nitrogen on, get an insane yield, but you had a huge protein spike, and all of a sudden the maltster's only interested in it for maybe specialty malts that are 1% of what they produce, right?
Because the brewer can't.
So for like your baseball, so what are the general qualities you're looking for? I mean, primarily barley, but like there are certain, you can tell me some of the analytics or the chemistry of it.
Yeah, so we're looking for well, the first big go,
Jeff,
no go.
Can I have more of your Bohemian Pills, please?
Yes, actually.
See, we're talking malt, but we're drinking lager. Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah. Before you get going, that I looked it up, and we brewed it 3 weeks ago yesterday.
Wow. Mm. That's awesome.
Yeah, Zane, so chemistry or...
But yeah, so the first no-go is having a lot of Dawn in the fields, in the barley.
This is DON. It's an acronym, and it's an acronym every maltster nationwide probably has nightmares about.
So what's DON?
It's a mycotoxin, basically. So it downstream causes gushing in beer and all this really nasty stuff that the brewers don't ever really have to deal with now because it's on the sort of the maltster to reject barley with high levels of DON.
And New York being as humid as it is particularly susceptible to this issue.
And especially with how much corn we grow, because it sort of flourishes in that climate.
So, you know, it can jump from a field of corn to a field of barley if they're close together and the wind catches just right, kind of a thing.
And then, for protein.
Darn that corn.
Yeah, no. Yeah. You know, 10 to somewhere like 11 to 13 kind of percent. Like, everything's a little bit of little flexible, but, you know, 14, 15% protein, it starts to... You can't really do anything with.
And Jeff, how do you you know, you get malt, you're making great beer. I mean, do you just see analytics like on a malt spec sheet, or do you ever have to get a little more involved and curious about it?
No, I think as long as you're not actually seeing problems in the end beer, then I think we just put a lot of trust in these guys. And you see analytic sheets and they mean different things to different people, and
yeah, very true.
Some people understand what all of it means, some people understand what none of it or some of it means, and I just think depending on how you brew and what you're looking for, you're either focused in on one or two of the pieces of the analytics or some or none or all.
I mean the big important thing, right, and this is kind of what Aaron pushes is don't think of it as a replacement, right? And I think as long as brewers are starting with that as their intention, they can make a good product, right? You have to think of this as a dynamic agricultural product, as a winemaker would with grapes, say. It's, you know, from a different, same variety, from a different field, the kernel plumpness might be a little bit different, and you have to set that mill gap a little bit differently to get good extract.
I really like to just kind of jump in initially, and then if you have some problems, then you can start to look at those numbers and start to have those conversations with the maltster, who is probably then turning around and having conversations with the farmer. And, you know, those are the types of things that I think are really valuable, and that's how we're going to grow going forward and how we've grown so far. But, I mean, to me, that's where the value is. You're not having that conversation with somebody, a wireman. I mean, maybe you are if you're really big, but...
Yeah, I mean, those conversations, I think, are... sort of, I mean, they're everything. You know, it's a dynamic process. And if you don't know if someone likes your product or doesn't like your product and you don't know why, then there's no opportunity to make anything better.
And to be honest, you know, even with these big maltsters, it's a dynamic product, oh, yeah. Right? They've found ways to kind of circumvent that a little bit by blending years and varietals to try to achieve more consistency. But at the end of the day, their malts are slowly changing over time too. And you know, they have a few more tools in their arsenal to make a more consistent product than we do. But they're working with barley, and, you know, barley's an agricultural product.
And then let's talk about what you guys do. So there, you had a cool photo on Instagram. You were holding roasted oats. So you obviously work with other grains besides barley.
Yeah, mostly in very small quantities. Even for us, you know, we can't malt a bunch of oats because it ties up our malting tank. But we're really looking for ways to explore other grains besides barley and what what flavors we can impart in our beer with those grains. So we recently got a small roaster and have been messing around with roasting oats and roasting barley.
Zane's being modest. He actually modified the roaster. It was a chili pepper roaster we bought off Craigslist. So it didn't even have like an actual like outside body to it at all. It kind of was corrugated, and he welded a couple of layers onto it so that it can, you know, actually hold heat
inside
of it.
You kind of just spin it and there's like
a motor on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're not trying to go too old school, just a little old school, but you know, it's open flame and can do about, you know, 5-7 pounds at a time on it, I think.
You literally just put it in, you spin it, and the chili gets roasted.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's like a little like 3/4 horsepower motor that direct drive, and we welded some sheets on there. And
so what are some of the grains that are growing in New York that you are working with or think there's potential to work with for malting besides barley's?
I mean, kind of everything. On the roasting side, we're roasting oats because we've seen some better color development more quickly than on the barley side. So, you know, we can kind of turn a few batches around in a few hours, and it gives us just a larger source of
color. So you put the roasted oats in just to...
Yeah, exactly. But any grain can be malted. It's just about sort of...
And those analytics are way more important on the barley side than on other grains. So,
Jeff, you got another beer here too, don't you?
So this will be what we're pouring tomorrow at Brewer's Choice. So this is a all New York State ingredient beer. It's got some of Ted Holly's New York Craft Malt Excelsior Pils, and then a newer harvest year. Excuse me. Of that sort of Whipple mystery hop. So this is the Whipple CTZ from probably a year after that.
You think over the last 5 years, like the arc of New York State malt, what's the hardest malt to get down that everyone wants?
That's an interesting question. I don't think we're quite there yet. I'd like to see us move towards a big, sexy malt that everyone wants.
Yeah, I mean, kind of the dream, I guess, for New York, if we really want differentiation, is to have a variety that grows well here, that, you know, we malt a little higher than a Pilsner malt, get a little bit more probably color and flavor development on
it. The agronomics have to be right on it.
But kind of something similar to either Full Pint, which came out of Washington State, right? Or was it Washington or Oregon State? That was a variety that, you know, is kind of synonymous with the Pacific Northwest now. And Maris Otter in the UK is kind of the other variety, right? People sell this malt based on the name of the grain variety.
Yeah.
And for a premium. So you will see where it goes. Who knows? That's a little bit of a pipe dream. But I think if everything really works out well, we'll find a variety or two in New York that we can really, like, stake our claim on in this state.
Jeff? Last thing about malt. So when you're a pro brewer, you've got great operation, Keg and Lantern, you guys are growing. What's the number one malt that you're buying? You know, is it from a certain malt facility? Is it a type of malt?
So We buy a lot from mainly two different producers, and both of those, unfortunately, are from overseas. So we buy a lot of Weyermann. We really like their base malts, the Pilsner malts, the Bohemian Pilsner malt, and then they have like a extra hell, like a premium, like extra light that we use in a lot of lagers. And then
and you make great lagers.
Thanks. And then a while back we got linked up with Holland Malt, and we think that they're turning out some really nice stuff, and have really enjoyed the relationship we've built with that company.
Are they based in the Netherlands?
So there are some people stateside who are sort of the people that I interact with, but yeah, the malt's coming actually from the Netherlands. Yeah.
And what, you know, we've never worked with malt from a foreign maltster. So could you tell us a little bit maybe about what, like how those relationships compare?
Oh. It comes with an accent, Max.
So actually we had been ordering Holland malt, pretty consistently. I mean, I'd say we at Keg & Lantern, we're a 3-barrel system in a basement right now. So we're buying like one pallet every, you know, if we're really cranking through beers at a really busy time of year, we're probably ordering one pallet of malt every 2 weeks. And I'd say once we took on the Holland malt and we used it in a few different styles of beers and really started to get our arms around it and realized that we enjoyed it, I'd say that we're ordering two pallets of that to every pallet of Weyermann. And we're sort of going to the Weyermann mainly as a source of specialty malts. So we'll get all the specialty malts we need, and then we'll just fill out the rest of the pallet with their base malt. And so with Weyermann, it's going through BSG. So it's, you know, I have like an internet relationship with BSG. It's just a, you know, back and forth about orders and whatnot. And I thought that's what we were doing with Holland. And then all of a sudden one day the guy, who's originally from the Netherlands, who's stateside now, who basically made this whole thing happen, just walked into our basement one day unannounced, and I didn't even realize who he was as we started to talk. And over the course of the conversation, I was like, oh my goodness, like this guy's actually like sort of the guy.
He just smelled that you were brewing, right? He knew.
he knew that we had been ordering for a while, and he just kind of came by to say hi. And I was pretty impressed by that. But you're never going to touch the, you know, relationships you can form with local
malt. Yeah, that's still awesome that you're getting that, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Change it to the smell of malt. What's it like being in a malt house? I mean, I love the smell when a brewer's brewing, you can smell that malt. But what about when you're making the malt? It's pretty great. What is the smell?
Germination, it's like
you get
cucumbers.
A little bit of cucumber. Yeah, a lot of fresh, sort of grassy sort of smells.
If you start getting that sort of lactic sourness, that's a bad sign. You want that fresh cucumber smell.
Yeah. But as it starts kilning, you know, think about walking into a bakery. You just get all these fresh, really crackery, interesting grain flavors as it's sort of working.
Yeah, I mean, when we're kilning the Vienna, you know, it's like and if you go in there, you know, midway through kilning or so, it's amazing. It's,
yeah,
you can, like, smell it from outside the building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get a little bit of almost a little peanut buttery kind of action, a lot of cracker, a lot of roasty, toasty, just beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of notes that definitely fade with time, you know, after that kilning is done, but are still present in the finished malt to some extent.
Wow, this is great, man. I tell you, just in 5 years, Jeff, things have come so far that we actually have the second brewery in New York State with Mario Matrazzo that's making malt and brewing with it. I don't know. Anybody want to close it out? Anything this? I feel like we're getting closer to what we expect from our, you know, craft products, artisanals, you know, cheese and wine and everything. It sounds like we're going in the right direction with you guys.
I think we're getting there. I think it's really exciting for us to see where the industry's come and where it's going. I mean, quality is number one, and it's continual quality.
And like we were talking about before the show, to see big guys using these ingredients finally is really affirming, right? I mean, I think Jeff agrees and Jason at Strong Rope agrees. Like, we're all small, and we're all going to stay small for a while. We can't support this supply chain alone.
And I like when we're talking about these malts that are like making these simple beers, lagers and pale ales and things. I want to joke and say, man, you guys should all make the peanut butter, you know, donut malt, you know, but there's a lot of crazy things happening in beers. And I still think beer is a beverage and it's good for you and it's from the earth. So
yeah, and malt's been around at least 10,000 years, right? The pastry stout thing has only been around.
You can put some donuts in your beer, but everyone just close it out. Guys, thanks so much again. Everybody, Jeff, thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you. Jeff from Keg and Lantern. I appreciate you having me on.
And we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you. Zane from Subversive Malting and Brewing.
And Max from Subversive.
And again, well, you guys, thanks so much for stepping up. It's Brewer's Choice event. We're not twisting anyone's arm, but people that are working with local malts are excited to be here. Even foam brewers are coming down from Vermont. You guys reached out and said, hey, this is what we're doing. We should be there. Indian Ladder also. People are really proud of, and some of them are growing grains too, which we didn't even get to today.
Yeah, Indian Ladder is the only estate brewery in New York State. That's a pretty cool achievement.
Yeah, I mean, I was there in 2016. I remember there was their first harvest of barley, and literally their combine broke. This is a whole other show. Their combine broke, and they were waiting for the rain clouds to come. So you know, everything with agriculture is fraught with risk. So appreciate what you guys do. Great work. And again, I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy. Engineer today is Max, and assistant producer, Aaliyah Papes. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.